Welcome to the actual episode 5 of the Tea and Tales podcast with myself, Bloody Drongo, and Renee Sky. How are you today, Ren?
I'm doing good. How are you going?
Very good. I'm very glad that we're finally recording actual episode 5. For anybody who missed the previous episode, I was misled at the start of the episode to believe that it was episode 5.
And I was misled as well by numbers as a whole being in a linear fashion.
Yeah, that so strange how that happens. But
I copped so much flack from that episode. I still get people in my DMs being like, you know, what episode was that you guys recorded? I'm like, I'm aware, I get it. It's been a couple of months. Message received.
Well, I mean, I would argue that you rightfully got a lot of flack for it as well, so yeah. No sympathy anyway. For me. I'm apologies.
Anyway, welcome to episode 6 of Tea and Tales.
So it's been a little while since the last episode, so no doubt we've got a lot to catch up on. The last time we spoke about the possum up your pipe and, you know, all of the other stuff that happened in amongst that. Since then, there has been, I'm sure, a few other adventures that you've been on. And there's also a few other things that I know we're both keen to talk about that has been happening in the publishing and kind of writing space as well.
Yes, yeah, that's been a big turmoil in Australian publishing at the moment, which we can dig into a little bit later. But if you were looking for the episode where we're going to talk about AI, this is that episode. So you've found the right one. We're probably just going to chitter-chatter a little bit before we get there. But no, you're on the right track, hey. As per tradition, which I think we forgot to do for the last couple of episodes, what are you drinking for this episode of Tea and Tales? Big bottle of water.
I'm drinking water.
That's very healthy.
I am very, yeah, well, I did indulge in a coffee this morning, and it was pretty good, but I am staying very hydrated at the moment.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad one of us is.
No, I love drinking water. I find it very easy these days to drink a lot of water.
I love that we've got the hot takes on this podcast. I love drinking water. I find it very easy.
Yeah, well, I know not everybody feels the same about water.
No, that's true. That's true. I've had some people with some pretty strong opinions about water in my life. So
I know some people that just don't drink water at all, and only
I don't know how they're alive.
Like how? What are you doing? Like there's some people I know that just drink like juice and like soft drinks or pop or soda, if you're more of the American persuasion. And
so much sugar.
That boggles the mind. Mm-hmm. Boggles the mind to me.
Yeah. I've got not water.
Okay.
This is a double shot of Rogue Energy and soda water.
Okay. Fair enough.
I decided to put it in soda water because a couple of people have been asking me about it. It doesn't play nice with soda water. It went everywhere. And a lot of people ask me, jokingly, if I've ever done a line of Rogue Energy, and now I can say that unwittingly, yes, because I was trying to hoover it off the top of the glass before it could go everywhere, and it turns out that was straight powder, and it wasn't mixed. It was a yummy flavor, but I don't recommend the experience. However, this, once it's settled, is quite nice. It looks a little radioactive, but it's quite nice.
It does look unnatural.
It's delicious. This is pink lemonade. And it actually just does taste, it just tastes like lemonade now. Because it's in the soda water. So,
enjoy it. I mean, it is the time of year where you can start to enjoy some nice cold beverages like that. Both.
Finally.
I know you're a warm weather person, and I'm somebody who is, you know, I'm pretty easygoing when it comes to climate. The only thing that I tend to not enjoy about this time of year is that in about a week's time, 2 weeks time is usually when my hay fever gets really bad. And for the next like 2 months, I will be completely miserable and just hating being alive. It'll be the worst.
Oh no, I didn't realize you got it that badly, you poor thing.
Oh, really bad. Yeah.
Oh, Every year, like clockwork.
Every year, like clockwork. And the wild thing is that it's only Australian species that I seem to be allergic to. So it's been pleasantly enjoyable going to other countries in the spring, because then I'm like, oh man, okay, you know what? Maybe I'm not somebody who's just all about like autumn and winter. Maybe I'm just somebody who enjoys not feeling like I'm dying.
Maybe you're just someone allergic to their own country.
Well, that is also true. That is something I have considered, and part of the reason why I have considered moving elsewhere.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that bad. I've never had hay fever in my entire life.
Well, lucky for some, I guess.
But, you know, like, I get sick in other ways. So,
right.
Like, for full disclosure, this is my third round of tonsillitis in 4 weeks. Yeah. I've had a double shot of Rogue Energy, but I've also had my lidocaine. So I'm a bit mellow at the moment and just vibing a little bit. There's lots going on. And I've spent the last like 4 weeks in just excruciating amounts of pain, and it really dampens your enthusiasm to live. It's been a struggle.
Do you have any, like, allergies?
No.
Right, gotcha.
I'm not allergic to anything, apparently. Yeah, just existing is what does the trick for my tonsils, so.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of people keep asking me if I'm going to have them out, and I've got two more holes that I need to punch on my loyalty card of tonsillitis before I get a free tonsillectomy courtesy of the Australian government. So.
Well, that's the thing, right, is that Australia has quite high requirements for actually removing your tonsils, unlike a lot of other countries. I think they just rip them out. So
they just tie them to a doorknob and slam the door like that, and you're out. That might be teeth. I might be getting that wrong.
That is teeth. Yeah. As an ex dentist, that's teeth. But
dentist?
No, that's not.
If you're not. No, you made shoes, not teeth.
Exactly. And believe it or not, they are different, despite what people say.
That's the title of this podcast, Shoes Are Not Teeth, episode 6.
Well, imagine if you had a pair of shoes, but the ankle hole had little teeth, little child teeth around the rim of them.
He's listening. His ears are burning out there. He's like, I'm going to write another weird Gizmo book.
Man, those books were so good, though.
They were bizarre, dude.
They were very weird.
Because Paul Jennings also wrote the Round the Twist series.
Yes.
But he also wrote the Gizmo series, which for any non-Australians, they are like, what? From what I remember, it was this little contraption machinery thing that literally adhered to your skin if you touched it. It's like a new hand has touched the beacon and will never, ever let go. It's sewn into your skin. Yep. It was real body horror.
Not written in the way of body horror.
Yes,
but
it was.
In reality, it was.
Dude had a thing stuck to his hand, and he like describes trying to pull it off his hand, and it describes his skin like stretching.
But it's not written. I feel like for anybody who's not aware of this, it's not written in the style of a horror book. It's a quirky children's book. In the same way that if you rationalize a lot of the storylines in Round the Twist, it's like that's horrifying. But in actual fact, the way it's told is fairly lighthearted, and it's a bit more normal than it actually sounds.
This is kind of like boiling down, like, Animorphs isn't actually war crimes because it's written for
Animorphs
children.
Oh, but Animorphs totally is war crimes.
It's war crimes.
I mean, that's a totally different kettle of fish. That one just straight up is.
Oh, gosh. Oh, goodness. That's a nice little segue into childhood literature. Yeah.
Yeah, apparently. I mean,
it was.
I know we have a lot of shared ground when it comes to the books that we kind of grew up reading. What is, like, looking back now as an adult, what are the ones that kind of stand out in your mind as being, like, most influential in your day-to-day life?
Oh, in day-to-day life? That's a really tricky one. I often credit Tamora Pierce as, like, one of the starting influences of my writing. She did fantasy, Alana, the First Adventure,
okay,
that kind of thing. She is quite a prolific writer. She's still writing to this day, and I really enjoy her writing style. We have very similar ones in which it's very, I think, our writing, mine and Tamora Pierce's. I think it's very easily digestible. I think fantasy tends to lend itself towards really heavy, sometimes very condensed prose. And I don't like jive that way. I like to write kind of really action movie kind of fantasy, and Tamora Pierce does as well. So I'd credit her, I think, with the biggest change, like the biggest influence on my day-to-day life, because I write every day. So what about yourself?
You know, it's a little bit hard to say. I think there's a couple of books that I think, in terms of like what I envisage my life could be like, that I find really kind of influential in really interesting ways. So there was a book, I forget who wrote it, but there's a book called Blueback. And it's basically about this guy who lives on the coast, and he goes out diving, and he meets this blue groper. And basically over the space of like, I think it's like 10, 20 years, or it could have even been a lifetime. It's like, it's almost like a life story sort of style book. And the fact that he's kind of growing up alongside this fish, and they have these unique interactions whenever he goes out diving, and he does like abalone diving and stuff like that. And the way that that book describes his house has kind of turned into like my dream house in a way. That's kind of like has become almost like what I would long-term aspire to have, which I think is like kind of like a very specific example of how like a book I read as a kid has influenced my life now, because it's kind of like what I would aspire towards. So that's one that definitely comes to mind in that sort of
conversation. I'm so curious about the kind of house.
Okay, you want to hear about my dream house now?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. All right.
But all?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So right near the ocean. So the way it's described in the book is being on a hilltop, and then having like these rolling hills, and that he's able to walk down to the water from down these hills. And at the hills, it kind of goes off to a little bit of like a steep kind of cliff. And then there's these steps that are kind of carved into the stone that go down to a jetty. So the idea I have is like this house that's like perched on a hill, not like on a beach or anything, but like on a hill. And it's described as being like right next to a wilderness area. So it's got a big backyard, and it kind of has like a wire fence that then backs directly onto a wilderness area. So you've got this like really thick, dense Australian undergrowth and bush. And then you've got a lot of wildlife as a result. And the backyard is so big that it's described as having like these orchard, like fruit trees, citrus trees, growing out there, and it's like some apple trees as well, I'm pretty sure. And then the house itself is a little bit like, not like super nice or anything, but it's like it's weathered and it's got character. But one of the defining features of it is the veranda. There's a beautiful veranda that looks out the back of the house and looks down towards the ocean. And there's like a few like scenes from that book that are like very vividly described, like looking out over the ocean, and then looking at the night sky, and then like going out in the morning and like having a coffee, and like the fresh wind blowing straight off the ocean, that salt air. Like there's just something about that to me that I just find like viscerally compelling as like this is something that would be a very nice way to live life. So That's kind of the house, you know?
The house.
The house.
Not a word of a lie, that sounds identical to where and how I grew up.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm from a coastal town in South Australia, and you've just basically described my childhood.
Is that right? That's kind of weird.
Yeah,
because I don't think we've ever talked about that before.
No. I'm from like a little area called the Fleurieu Peninsula, and it's really, really big on basically, I guess, like coastal culture. A lot of the books that we read in school growing up were like Storm Boy by Colin. Yep. That's going to drive me crazy.
Colin Teely. I actually don't know how it's pronounced.
I think it's Colin Teely. Yeah, because that's based in the Coorong, which is just outside of Goolwa. And Goolwa is actually where the Murray River meets the sea in South Australia. That's the other end of it. So that's a really big kind of like area that has a lot of cultural importance to a lot of people in the area. And yeah, that sounds like really very similar to A, how I grew up, B, the books that we read, and media kind of permeating my childhood kind of thing. So it's interesting. I love that you chose an Aussie author. I'm assuming, but it's an Aussie author.
I'm pretty sure. I might even still have it back.
You use the word veranda. It has to be Australian. If you have the book, that's going to be amazing. Spotify, he's examining a bookcase intently. I've never seen the back of your head before, sir.
Well, there you go. You're welcome. Yeah, here we go. Oh, it's by Tim Winton. I can't believe that I forgot that this is by Tim Winton. You'd know Tim Winton, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So here we go. So the blurb on the back is, Abel Jackson loves to dive. He's a natural in the water. He can't remember a time when he couldn't use a mask and snorkel to glide down into the clear deep. Life is tough out on Longboat Bay. Every day the boy helps his mother earn their living from the sea and the land. It's hard work, but Abel has the bush and the sky and the bay to himself. And until the day he meets Blueback, the fish that changes his life. Blueback is a story about people learning from nature, a boy, and his lifelong friend.
Oh, that's a good blurb.
It's a great book. It's a great book. I haven't gone back and read, like, this is a young adult's book. Like, it's, you know, it's not particularly long. It's got, you know, very big text. It
looks middle grade.
Pretty much. But this book stuck with me. So it's, yeah, I'll have to go back and reread this.
Not because me fiercely trying to remember a culturally relevant title so I can sound just as scholarly. There's nothing.
What? I read a middle grade book and now it's become my life aspiration because I have no original thoughts. Therefore, I am scholar.
No, it's like the inverse. Like you've chosen a piece of like Australian literature and it's grown and shaped you as an Australian adult. And that's important. That's the reason we do all of this.
I suppose that's true. Also, throughout this podcast so far,
about this.
I have had to continually adjust your volume on the recording, because just in case anybody listening to this is like, wow, Ren started out really peaky.
I'm so sorry.
I've been adjusting it down because Ren was like, yeah, no, this is definitely the volume I'm going to be speaking at during the recording. I'm like, okay, cool. And then immediately she's gotten very excited. So
I said if I get excited, my volume will go up. Also, the lidocaine's wearing off and the rogue energy is kicking in, all right?
Yeah, all right. We're in the crossover period.
Mm. On that note, now that I'm very excited about books and their place in our culture and society, I do want to turn to probably our biggest topic today. We can catch up on our personal projects, I think, later.
Yeah.
I want to have a chat about Australian authors being caught up in this AI evolution. I don't know how, emergence? I don't know how else to describe it. So basically, a couple of days ago, 4 or 5 days ago, a journalist came up with a search tool to be able to search a database called Books3, which is used to train certain AI writing software. It's not used for ChatGPT or OpenAI. I do believe those are Books 1 and 2, which have no association with Books 3. Books 3 was created to be a competitor to those two, and the creator of Books 3 has obviously decided that copyright is more of a suggestion than actual guidelines, and has scraped a whole bunch of books off the internet that are still covered by relevant copyright, and I think 18,000 Australian authors have been caught up in that, but didn't know until this journalist managed to create a way to search that database via ISBN and title, which allowed authors to look up to see if their work had been mined without their consent. And yes, a lot of Australian authors have been caught up in it and understandably pretty upset. So I wanted to bring this to the floor in a capacity in which I can talk about it undistracted. I've been getting a lot of queries about what I think of AI in a creative space on stream. However, when I'm streaming, I'm talking to about 200 people and fighting battles and making barrels and, you know, generally failing at streaming video games, as well as failing at trying to explain my stance on AI. My stance on AI is that I hate it. And it needs to go away. But that's a very juvenile take. So if you needed the TLDR, it's that I'm not a fan and no one should be. And like, I will take a really hardline stance on this. I think we've discussed it a little bit on the podcast in the past because we were talking about submissions.
Yeah.
And we were talking, well, we blatantly stated that we're not interested in anything that's been generated or been helped along by AI. And I've been trying to think to myself over the last week, how do I explain why I don't see Books 3, I'm going to use them as my little victim, because they've decided to make victims out of 18,000 Aussie authors who have worked extremely hard to be paid not much. I'm trying to see from their point of view why they thought that copyright wouldn't apply to them. And it's because they believe, and we've talked about this in the past, copyright dictates whether or not a work is derivative or transformative. It's transformative. It's not protected by copyright because it's considered changed enough to no longer resemble. I think the example we used was you drawing an apple, me drawing an apple, et cetera, et cetera. Or derivative is the other one, which is that it has not been changed enough and it too closely resembles the original work to be covered by its own copyright. It's not enough of its own original idea. And the best way I could come up with explaining the differences, because the number one thing I get on stream, and I've seen it on my author friends as well, on their posts on Facebook, saying, what's the difference between a machine reading your book and learning from it, and a human reading your book and learning from it? I have like a good answer for this, and I have a smart ass answer to this, and I'm fighting every ounce of my body to not give the smart ass answer. So I'm going to try and give the good one that I've spent the last week prepping in my head. First of all, for this analogy to work, do you know what Plinko is? Plinko is that game where you drop a little piece in at the top of the board, and it hits all those different pegs, and it's like do 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 do, and it like changes course, and then eventually down the bottom it falls into like a number of like little barrels or something. It's usually like an arcade game. Right. And it's like, try to win 50 tickets by getting the little Plinko token to fall into.
I know what you're talking about. I never knew that was what it was called.
It's called Plinko, yeah.
Okay, there you go.
In the way that I see it is that when a human is like, I'm going to write a novel, I'm going to read all of Tamora Pierce's catalog. They read all of Tamora Pierce's catalog. And this idea, this novel idea, the Plinko token, starts its descent down. But all the little pegs that poke out and change its direction, those are that author's, as in like the person who is writing this new book, that is their personal experience, their way of seeing the world, the way they communicate, their writing skill. There's 100,000 deviations and variations that is specifically made up and unique to them and their journey through the world so far. Everything they've been through has shaped the person that they are and the way that they communicate. So that little Plinko token hits all these little variations and unique experiences, and out the bottom drops this transformative novel that might have started as inspired by Tamora Pierce, but has been changed by the human experience that we can't reliably chart, because everyone has a different experience of living in the world these days. The AI version of that, if the human is a Plinko board, the AI version of it is a Connect 4 board. AI doesn't have those experiences and those different ways of growing up and those variations and those prejudices and those biases that we're going to see from the human author. It just regurgitates the words in a different format. And I think that's why they're going to lose the case in terms of transformative versus derivative, because they can't offer enough change from that work, because the AI just can't.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. I think I have a different take on this because I think they'll lose.
I think they'll lose.
So, it's worth mentioning that a lot of the copyright law, both in Australia and in a lot of other Western countries, is measured off a similar standard to what the US copyright system is. And there is essentially with copyright in the US, there is a four-prong test that they generally go by to measure whether something becomes fair use. And a lot of the official response around from these companies that are using this data set has been that it does fall under fair use. And so the first prong of the test is the purpose and character of your use. So whether or not you're making money from it, which they are. The nature of the copyrighted work. So, what it is actually, whether it's a direct copy of the thing that they've taken, and whether that is identical or a parody, because it is worth mentioning in there that you can, under fair use, make something that is notably almost identical for the sake of parody, but it's still considered fair use from a legal standpoint. And then the other, the third prong is the amount and the sustainability of the portion taken, which in this case is the entirety of the original data set. However, when that conversation is had from a legal standpoint, and this is why I think it falls down, and what the current precedent set around that third prong is that it is the actual output, the thing that is produced.
No.
So
no.
The idea that you can take somebody's work and then turn it into something else and it becomes something that does not immediately represent or be very similar or noticeably similar. And if we're talking about a data set that combines 18,000 different authors, anything that's generated from that data set is probably not going to be notably identical to a significant degree to any singular one of those authors, which makes it very, very difficult for them to argue, in my opinion, that it is substantially taking a portion of their work to create something else. And then finally, the third prong is the effect of the use upon the potential market. Now, this is probably, I think, the one that is the most contentious, because I think from my perspective, there is a really, really strong argument to make that by taking this data set from these authors without their permission, it does directly impinge upon their ability to enter into the market and sell things, sell their own intellectual property. However, the argument that they to counter that is the fact that because they are generating something that, if it passes the third prong, is essentially its own product, so therefore it is its own unique thing, which then is saying, well, you know what, you're open market, you have to compete against that, and that is what it is. So the third prong is really where I think it comes down to, and I think there was a really interesting article that you linked me to, Ren, from the University of Wollongong, Australia, from the Dean of Law there, Dylan Thampaliani. And basically they're talking in there that essentially, in their opinion as well, that the law just isn't there to support the authors and upholding copyright. And that is, I think, the sad reality, is that the law just doesn't have the proper protection there for people that have copyright, especially when they're competing against AI and the idea of like taking data. And that's what all of these books come down to, is it's raw data for these learning algorithms to use. So I don't think it's right, but I, this is definitely to me a case of, even if it is technically legal, it's not right to do, and I don't like it.
Technically legal, you're in the wrong.
Yeah. Immediately. Yeah, 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 yeah. Just because it's law doesn't mean it's right.
I'm gonna offer a rebuttal if that's okay.
Sure.
Third prong. I think if they're focusing on output, being like, well, we only used a paragraph of Stephanie Parkin's books. I think what the authors are going after, being led by the ASA, which is the Australian Society of Authors, I think what they're going after is the act of their books being scraped, which technically will be the full copyrighted input.
Yes.
They're not focusing on output there, which might tank that third prong, because you can't take 100% of a copyrighted item, and you sure as shit can't use it to make money off of in any capacity. So this is going to be really interesting. I 100% agree with you that the law just isn't there. Yeah. And the law is not keeping up. And this is where we really need to, I think, I do believe it was in the Guardian article that I linked to. Basically, they've turned around and gone, we actually need the federal government here. This isn't just a matter for, this isn't just a matter for the ASA versus Books 3. This is that we need the federal government getting involved and actually being lawmakers and addressing emergent technology and the way that that threatens our arts and culture.
100%.
And it's just, I try so hard to not get like super passionate about this, not get super worked up, because, well, feelings shouldn't really count in a courtroom. I feel sad that my book has been taken. That's great. You can feel that way about a Big Mac that doesn't live up to your expectations. But what we care about is protecting ourselves with facts and laws. And it just makes me so mad.
It should.
It makes me so angry that for some reason people are like, yeah, AI, it's a fantastic technology. That's awesome. Use it in medicine, use it in science to crunch large amounts of numbers and free up our brains to do like the big things, right? I can't speak for science or technology. I can't speak for science or medicine because my brain is not. Obviously, I don't work in that field. When it comes to creative industries, are we not trying to free up more time for us to be able to sit and like paint and write poetry? Is that not, humans have been storytellers from the get-go. Are you really trying to tell me that we want to be spending our days working in a factory so we can consume the next chapter from ChatGPT's, I don't know, Big Brother fan fiction? Like, it's the wrong way around.
Well,
flip it over.
So I think that the problem really is that within all of the creative arts, almost all of it exists within an inherently late capitalist framework, which means that all of it is created, well, not all of it, a large amount of it that we are regularly consuming and have the easiest access to is done for profit, in the sense that you are, supporting these creators. And I say that as a creator, and you're a creator as well, that we exist within a capitalist framework. We need to be able to pay our bills. We need to pay rent. We need to be able to buy food. And so we're inherently trapped within that cycle of having to create content with the idea of making money from that as well. And it's always a balancing act of creating something and creating something that is going to be able to be monetized.
Yeah.
And when you take that small leap of creating something to be monetized, and the fact that there's a lot of demand for that in the creative space, and people would love to consume that, because guess what? All of those people who'd work a 9-to-5 or a factory job or something like that, they want to be able to come home and they want to be able to consume something. But the vast majority of those people don't care what it is, as long as it's enough to, you know, distract them or to help them disassociate for a while or to help them, enjoy something or feel something. That's good enough. And I think sometimes the threshold to that, a lot of the time, the threshold is not about quality, it's about quantity. And putting out enough stuff out there to be consumed. And I think that's where, like, realistically, I could see in like 5 to 10 years time where AI really takes the lead, where it becomes plausible enough that it kind of can replicate almost an original work from the perspective of being inspired by or derivative of other things, but being of decent enough quality that it doesn't feel inhuman. And that's where it becomes really dangerous, because it's like, well, where are the other human creators? Because they're not going to be able to keep up with the consistent 24-hour output. And if you've got companies like Amazon, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, all these giant multi-billion, trillion-dollar companies able to produce mass content for people to consume that want to demand it at a pace that is far beyond any individual's, it's going to go from where we are now and have been for the last 10 years, I think, in like the golden age of individual creators being able to enter into a market and find an audience for whatever it is, whether it's art, whether it's music, whether it's, video content, whatever it is. The cost of equipment has come down significantly, and there has been a lot of platforms that have given people an audience to then going into almost like a creation dark age where there's just a inundated amount of just derivative AI generated stuff that is, there's nothing there that's going to be truly special, but it's going to be good enough to be very popular, and it's going to be able to be consumed at such huge quantities that it's just going to push everybody else of the market, or at least make it extremely hard for people who are making original things to find an audience.
Mm. Have you ever watched debates and you see like the other team, as the debater is talking, the other team's taking notes really fast?
Yeah.
I finally understand why they do that. Because I've had like five thoughts. Number one is, you're talking about how in this, what do you call it, this late stage capitalist framework?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
We create content with the intention of monetizing it.
Yeah.
I think that's the death of their fourth prong right there, which is that they are directly impacting our ability to monetize our creative content by doing this. And that could actually serve as just the groundwork for ditching AI in a creative sphere altogether, is that for people who monetize their content, make their living off of it, creative AI in a creative setting threatens that entirely. It's a huge, like, copyright aside, that's messed up. Second point I wanted to make was, I just wanted to put some, like, a little factoid on the table, which is that for good, well-selling authors in Australia, their median wage, their average wage is $18,200 a year, which is actually a minimum wage in Australia. That's the tax-free threshold,
that's,
I think.
That's not minimum. The minimum the tax-free threshold in Australia is around 21,000, I'm pretty sure.
Hang on. No, because the number stood out to me as being like, the 2023 tax-free threshold is 18,200.
Oh, is it?
So
okay.
An right, author makes exactly that.
Yeah, right. So, there you go.
That's wild.
But that's not minimum wage. Minimum Isn't wage it? In Australia, if you're for most industries, because obviously we do industry standards for minimum wage, I think is usually going to be around 46,000.
Okay. Oh god, that's worse.
Oh yeah. It's definitely worse.
Minimum wage.
Oh yeah, 100%. It's way worse.
Ah, good. Yes, thanks. Books 3, go after.
But you also don't have a lot of full time authors. Like, the vast minority of authors in Australia or in the world are not full-time.
So then I want to bring up monetary value versus inherent value to a culture. That's a
okay.
whole separate tangent that sure. I'd like to go on later. I wanted to say as well, when you're saying, like, with AI being able to, in the next couple of years, be able to do derivative work so well that it's almost indistinguishable from the original content. My God, that just took me into like this dystopian ass future, like
oh,
a
it
decade,
is so
half a decade.
Dystopian.
And it's like, we lose these court cases and this is what happens. And instead of reading Richard Flanagan's new book, you read a derivative of Richard Flanagan's library. And that, like, they've got the names of the authors on them. And it's like, it's not the actual authors, but we lost so many lawsuits that the authors can't even claim their own freaking names anymore. And instead it's just ChatGPT just pumping it out. You know, like the next James Patterson, oh my God, James Patterson would take over the world. He'd just merge with an AI. Good gravy. I want to bring up as well, I was going through the Guardian article and just like having a little fact checked. The second to last line in the Guardian article that we've been referencing is Australian copyright law protects creators of original content from data scraping.
Okay.
It's just there in plain text. So okay. Best of luck to your books three, except not at all. Step on a Lego. There was another quote that I wanted to bring up, and I think it was from Mr. Flanagan. If I'm misquoting you, I'm very, very sorry. There was this quote that I kind of went, okie dokie. It kind of just came out of left field. It was like a little bit of a drive-by. Oh, goodness gravy. Sorry, I cannot for the life. It might have been the ABC article we've been chatting about, I think. Ironically, one of the University of New South Wales chief scientists has had his book scraped. And it's called Machines Behaving Badly, The Morality of AI. And I'm so sorry, but you do have a wee giggle. I'm so sorry, Mr. Toby Walsh. Professor Toby Walsh. Sorry, sir. That's so incredible irony. I'm so sorry. He was actually the one that spoke the quote that I wanted to bring up. He says, if you just want to train a chatbot to speak English, there are tens of thousands of books that are out of copyright that they could have used, he says. Mm. It's typical of the cavalier way that people in Silicon Valley treat people's intellectual property. Is this an ongoing issue? Well, I've never heard of this before. Do Silicon Valley inventors just kind of like take what they can and run with it? Is this like a bit of a cultural issue we've never talked about in terms of...
Look, I'm not super into like the Silicon Valley kind of tech culture or anything like that. But, you know, I think it is a pretty common meme that it's like a very cutthroat place and people are always stealing other people's ideas and like, you know, taking other people's intellectual property and stuff like that. I think that's a pretty common attitude that a lot of people kind of have about it. So, yeah.
Okay, because I was just reading through this article and I went, okay, that I kind of really enjoyed it because he is right. There are so many books out of copyright that they could have used. 100%. So many.
Well, a lot of them would have had a lot of weird, outdated perspectives, which maybe might be why they preferred not to use out of copyright books. Just spitballing here.
No, they for real wanted the tagline of, do you want to write like James Patterson? Now you can. Use Books 3 or whatever. Books 3 is being used to train one of the AIs. I can't remember the name of it. Stupid bloody things.
I think it's like Llama or something.
That's my derivative face, by the way.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
My condolences.
Yeah, anyway, this whole subject is incredibly frustrating and I love getting so many people in my chat being like, what's the difference between a machine and an AI reading all of the books or learning all of the art? And it's like,
well, it's just not the same. It's just a completely different comparison. Like
Plinko versus Connect Four. I'm sticking with that analogy. That's my go-to now.
Well, the thing that kind of like stands out to me when you're talking about that analogy is that you mentioned, like, if you have a person read a dozen books and then write their own book that is directly inspired by those dozen books, and then it ends up being something else because of the lived experiences. I think there is a section of audience that is listening to us now that would try and make the argument that because of the extreme amount of volume that an AI is able to consume in comparison to an individual person to inspire their own books, that it would kind of offset the amount of, or the lack of lived experience to kind of create something new. But I would argue that the differentiating factor is that there is going to always be, Well, not necessarily always, because I've definitely read books that are almost directly derivative of other ones, and I don't like those anymore, to be clear. But I think the books that I like and I respect and I would love to be able to see created in the future, even if they are inspired by other works, have their own unique creation and have made their own idea up within it. And they have their own unique perspective. And that is something that an AI just can't replicate at the moment, at least, is they are always going to be reliant on the data set that they have at their disposal, even if it is 18,000 different books and it's merging them all together in a particular style. It's still a case of there's not really any original thought and any original perspective going into it. It's always going to be completely derivative at the moment.
That's the difference between derivative and transformative. Yes. Yep. I hope people have like a clearer understanding of copyright, because I get a lot of I catch a lot of flack on stream, just like as a bit of a drive-by of people complaining about copyright music. Because I'm sure as like a streamer, like you've run into the whole no copyrighted music on stream.
Yeah.
A lot of people like crack the shits with that in such a big way, and I'm like, no, I get it. Like, I don't want to peel the tin off a can of worms here. I don't want to peel the lid off of it. But streaming is a bit of a grey area mm-hmm. when it comes to making game studios content basically freely accessible in return for monetary value to both ourselves and to Twitch. We release a lot of the game, a lot of copyrighted content, and I would hope that we transform it enough with our commentary and live gameplay. But it's we started peeling the lid off a little bit with Nintendo, and then this whole can of worms started coming out, and we all quickly like put the lid back on. And that
right,
was a couple
okay.
of years ago.
So you're talking about the fact that technically the display and streaming and video capture of video game content and narrative content is technically copyright infringement as written under a lot of the EULAs. It's just basically an industry accepted goodwill agreement not to enforce that because they mutually benefit, right? That's what you're talking about here. Yeah,
yes.
Okay, I'm with
yes.
you.
Sorry, my little brain... Yeah, it had a junction, went down a bit of a different track.
Sure.
yes, this happened a couple of years ago. This was around 2021, I think, and I actually consulted with a couple of people in my professional sphere that work in copyright, and basically gave them the facts, and they turned around and went, yeah, game studios should be charging you guys a streaming fee. And I went, ooh, oh no, let's not go down that path anymore, please. Because... For larger streamers like yourself and myself, I wouldn't be willing. Please don't get any ideas, game studios listening to this. I'd be able to kind of pick like four games that I was going to play that year and pay the streaming licenses money depending on how much that was. But for smaller streamers, variety streamers, that's it for them. They're sunk, they're gone. And this has changed into an entirely new subject. It's kind of still copyright, but... just different facets of it. Yeah. Sorry,
yeah,
I just completely went down a different line.
I think generally speaking, I'm very glad that that isn't a line that has chosen to be enforced. I think that there would be a reasonable argument to be made that a lot of video game content is transformative. From the perspective that a lot of it is personality based, there is some streamers and some content creators that aren't really so much personality based, and they don't offer a lot of commentary, or they don't offer a lot of other aspects. And that's a conversation that happens a lot around the reaction space, you know, whether it becomes transformative, are you offering enough commentary to make it transformative, and things like that. And I think the vast majority of people that stream video games do make it transformative from the perspective that it is, most games are not a single track experience, and they have made it uniquely themselves by participating in that interactive experience.
True.
So
yeah, I think that's a good answer.
I think even if technically, as the, you know, the EULAs are written, probably infringes on their copyright, but I think there's a very good reason why they haven't decided to pursue it, because I think long term it would be extremely bad for those companies, it would be extremely bad for the creators, and it would set an extremely bad precedent for other industries as well. And I think that the one of the big things that kind of stands out to me, because you mentioned at the start of that that you get a lot of people that complain about music copyright specifically, I think the problem and part of that resentment comes from the huge amount of overbearing and bad actors that come through in the music space, specifically on YouTube. And I think that's kind of the culture that we've grown up within the last 10 years, is people copyright claiming music pieces that aren't even theirs. And yeah, there's a whole system within, under the good the safe harbor provisions that YouTube has been offered and has to abide by for copyright and their protection of the platform, that has created an ecosystem where it just allows so many people to take advantage of those that weighted balance that is always on the side of the claimer versus the person who's put it out there, the content creator, that creates a lot of resentment, and rightfully so. But it almost becomes a conversation of all of this structure that we have is inherently the fault of the system that we're operating within. Like, the whole idea of the safe harbor provision and the fact that it has to be weighted towards the claimee directly benefits large multi-billion dollar companies, because they are the ones that stand to lobby the government and the legislators the most. And there is an argument to be given that they should be able to, you know, protect their works. But at the same time, the system is broken for a lot of people that participate within that system. So,
yeah, definitely. Overall, I think this is a multifaceted industry, which is not super duper being paid the amount of attention it needs to in this day and age. I don't think the emerging technologies sector has been given the resources required to keep up in a legislation context. I don't think world governments are kind of being like, wow, a lot of stuff's changing super quickly and our laws aren't keeping up with it. Better shovel some more resources into maybe redrafting some laws to make sure that we're keeping ahead of this thing. I don't see that movement. If it's happening, I apologize to anyone that is, you know, trying to make those things happen. But we're not seeing those at a consumer level just yet. So, you know, time will be faster.
I would argue that it probably has never happened, that the law has always significantly lagged behind the need for legislation. It's very rare that something has been legislated preemptively ahead of a problem. And because of the whole way that system works and the fact that usually politicians and legislative bodies won't tend to act in any kind of significant capacity until it is obvious that it is a dire situation, that there's probably not an imminent relief in sight from that perspective.
Good. I love that. That's great. You remember a little while ago, you and I were having a meeting and you were trying to teach me the difference between reactive and proactive movement?
Yeah.
This is sounding very similar. I think we need to travel to Canberra, and I think we need to schedule a sit down Parliament House, and I think they need the same talk, because reactive legislation's not brilliant. It's not great. We have some of the best universities in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we not discussing this with experts and kind of being like, what would you recommend that we like prepare for within the next 20 years of emergent technologies?
Well, I think the general problem is, when you talk about proactive legislation, is that the data doesn't exist to properly identify the problem that you're trying to solve.
We have enough data and we have enough precedent being set now to project what's going to happen, to at least put some fail safes in place.
Well,
why has this become a podcast about telling our government how to do its job?
Yes, we can see the problem now, but what is the answer? How do you put into legislation, how do you put into law protections to that problem? Because there is still potential aspects to the problem that we just don't understand yet. And this is like always the problem and always why the law is trying to catch up, right? especially in regards to technology.
Will be assessed on a base on a what's it called, a case by case basis, as per determined by a judge of the law. Which basically gives judges agency to create precedent, which they already do.
They do.
So by just giving us a little more wiggle room, that being said, our copyright laws are already in place protecting this data scraping. So I don't know.
We'll see.
I've gotten to the end of my tinny and my political rambling has come to an end. I feel like I'm sitting in a pub trying to tell Albo how to do his job with having no idea really of what's going on. All I can say is that as a creative director of a small fantasy publisher in Australia, I am so heartbroken for people that I know personally and professionally and respect and admire them greatly in both of those spheres. To see them talking about finding their books. The only thing that I can kind of offer in comparison experience is finding my book on pirating websites. It's a unique feeling. It's this really, until you've experienced it, I don't think you'll ever really understand it. Because I get people coming into Chattel Time being like, yo, I pirate books, what of it? And I'm like, you are literally shit. Thanks, bro. I have people super proud of it. Occasionally they'd be like, yeah, I just pirate books. I never pay for them. It's like, wow, imagine admitting that. Finding Her Crown of Fire on a pirating website was just like, I don't really know how to feel about it. I still don't really know how to feel about it. It was seeing 5 or so years of my life, this book that had literally taken like blood, sweat, and tears, had been my entire life for a majority of that time, and someone had just uploaded like a PDF. My passion, like my hard work, my editor's hard work, my graphic designer's hard work, our interior formatter, an entire team of creatives, and the $2 that we were owed had just been forfeited in .pdf. And yeah. It was just like, wow. Like, that is next level insensitive. And I felt sick. I think that's the best way to describe it as well. I wasn't angry. I wasn't sad. I kind of felt violated. It's this really hard thing to describe. It makes you feel worthless entirely. And it's like someone out there thinks so little of your creative output that you are worth their 13 megabyte upload on a 5 p.m. like Tuesday afternoon, you know? And they were just like, yeah, I read this book. Other people might want to read it too. Upload it to this stupid library and let people just download it for free. And that's where their thought process stops. So finding your book being scraped and then having the person that's responsible for it turn around and go, well, you didn't say we couldn't. Like, I'm going to say that Gladiator Rings existed for a reason. And I'd like to see that again. No, I'm not wishing harm.
Okay.
But I'm mad.
I'm going to take that opportunity with the Gladiator Ring to move on to a segue. So, I don't know if you've spent much time on TikTok in the last, last 15 days, 20 days?
If I have, it's to be watching your adventures with Herrika.
Gotcha. So, on TikTok over the last couple of weeks, there has been a trend where females will ask males how often they think about the Roman Empire. And I would ask you, Ren, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? Because I have a theory about this.
Every time I see that stupid bloody meme, for starters. I would.
So you are aware of this then?
I know the meme, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's on Instagram too.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. So, meme aside, before this all started, I would say I thought of it every time I was prompted. Like, I think of history a fair bit. I watch like documentaries on YouTube a fair bit. So I would say probably more than the average person, just because I have a natural interest in history.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Because that was kind of like my theory. So my theory is more that not so much the fact that it's like a femme versus mask thing, it's a thing of like what the generalized interests of people are, right? And I think that there's a lot of people that, and a lot of guys I know that are very interested in history and the idea of like martial combat. And I think if you have a general interest in those things, you probably are going to find yourself thinking about Roman history because it's just such a dominant part of like European-esque history. And the other thing is that my theory is that people that are brought up in Eastern countries and Middle Eastern countries maybe think of it less or not at all. Because I think in the Western world, we have like this European, Eurocentric history that we're kind of taught. And a big part of the influencing that through into the Dark Ages was the Roman Empire. So I think that kind of like becomes like a dominant figure, even though in a historical context, you know, it was significant, but it wasn't like the biggest empire or anything like that. And it arguably may not have had some of the biggest influences on today's world, even though a lot of, you know, things you could make arguments for. But my theory is that it is because of like what our people's generalized interests are, right?
I think that's a really good. I think that's a really good insight, and I just want to take this moment to be like, I now understand how you managed to segue that. That's actually super impressive, because at first I thought you were just being like, I need to shut my co-host up. She's gone weird. But now I understand that. Yeah, you heard me. You heard me say gladiator, and you're like, yeah, Roman Empire. I wonder how often.
Literally, yeah.
But I think that's a really good point that it's not. Men versus women, it's not a gender war. Cover your ears, chat. It's just that, well, surprisingly, humans are people, and we have general interests that are shared between us, no matter what we have in our pants. So that's fascinating, quite frankly. It's almost like men and women come from the same branch of humanity. I don't know anything about biology.
At least most of them, in my experience. There are some that I have question marks about.
There's, namely, their inability to stop rambling about random shit. I would say that, like, in our gaming community, gaming communities, I'd say there's a nice big, like, three-sided Venn diagram. We've got gaming,
okay,
reading,
yes,
and history.
Yes.
Big intersection of those three.
Absolutely. 100%.
No idea 100%. Why.
And but, yeah. I think within that, especially within all of those spheres, you have a lot of very common elements that are quite prevalent within that.
What kind of elements?
So I would say that a lot of those elements are influenced quite heavily by, like, if we're talking about history, and again, from a strictly like Western, especially education background, like some of the more dominant themes within the history, within gaming and within reading are going to be, and even when we look at fantasy, are going to be themes that are dominated by Eurocentric ideas, and so, or periods of time. So you have, you know, there's obviously over the last 5-10 years, there's been a huge interest in the idea of like the Viking era, and then you've got like the constant fascination that, put you know, that it dominates gaming to this day of like the medieval and the Dark Ages and stuff like that, which directly then relates into the Roman Empire, which preceded it and then heavily influenced a lot of the things that happened there theoretically. And then you've also got you know, a lot of the, you know, Germanic sort of influences and cultural influences. And then even if you think around the Mediterranean, also like the Egyptians and the Carthaginians, and, you know, there's a lot of these, and the Greeks as well. You know, these are all things and themes that you will see pretty reoccurring within reading, books, games, and history when we're talking about those things.
It'd be really fascinating to find, like, actual themes and topics that cross those three, like boiling them down to actual terms. Mm-hmm. Now you've got me thinking about market research. Because I'm thinking like from a, and I would say that I've got my editor's hat on at the moment. I'm looking mm-hmm. for, I'm looking for common themes across the three. And I'm seeing like a little bit of a lust for adventure, for glory, heroes and heroines, stories to aspire to. I would say that maybe, and I might be getting like a little philosophical here, but I think at the core of human experience, well, that's a good start to that sentence, is we as humans, we wanna quest, we wanna be heroes, we wanna fight things and win. That's just always been in our nature, is to kind of, you know, walk to the next ocean and see what's beyond the horizon. We're explorers, we're adventurers, we're warriors, and we always have been. Like, that's just what most of us, I would argue, in some way or another, no matter how it's maybe been dampened by modern convenience, are at heart. That's why we go hiking. That's why we learn new skills. That's why we read and consume vast amounts of fantasy novels, because we're trying to live out experiences that in a modern world we just can't have. I'm not going to encourage the audience to go pick up their sword and wander down the street, because that is carrying, that's carrying a weapon in public and you will get arrested. So don't do that. Do go climb a mountain though, safely, you know, put your nice hiking boots on, take a lot of water with you and go and enjoy the nature sights. Defo do that. But those, I'm looking for common themes across these three areas of interest, and those are what I'm coming up with. Which is that humans at heart are adventuring warriors.
So I think I want to take it back another step further from that idea that we're adventuring warriors.
Yeah.
And say that humans at their cause want meaning. Well, we're all, more or less, we're all looking for some kind of meaning. And for some people, that's their family. Some people, that's, you know, their friends, it's their career, you know, it's any number of different things. We're all looking for meaning. But there is something that is very, very understandable and uniting in the concept of survival being your meaning. And I think, generally speaking, there is, for a lot of people, a desire to have some kind of simplification in the meaning. And being able to survive against the elements, against a common enemy, whatever that may be, from surviving against rent and bills and taxes and your horrible boss and God knows whatever.
Surviving against rent.
Surviving your podcast co-host, you know, any number of different things that seem trivial and mundane.
Yeah. I think we've talked about this before, actually, which is that one of the traits that we admire most as humans is persistence in the face of adversity. We all want to kind of defy the odds and come out on top. And I think you've accidentally landed on this weird fascination we seem to have, I'd say maybe in the last 20 or 25 years or so, with the zombie apocalypse. We all seem to want... We think we want, because I can guarantee you it would happen and we'd be like, oh my God, there's no hot water or tampons. I don't want this at all. This is horrific. You know? but I will say, I live with my cousin Horbert, and I can hand to my heart, swear that nothing would make his day more than me knocking on his door and saying, Horbert, get your sword. The zombie apocalypse has started. And I'm sticking to him like a limpet, because that's the only way I'm surviving.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this kind of like wriggly need to get out from under these established structures. We think we want to get out from under these established structures with their electricity and creature comforts and modern conveniences. No, we want to fight something and be admired for it. And we want that to be the personification of a monster, not capitalism, because it's harder to fight a faceless being.
It is. It 100% is. Yeah.
And it's not as glory. It's not as full of glory.
Exactly. I think I agree, because like I routinely fight the urge to just give up on everything and then buy some land and build a log cabin and become a hermit.
My friends and I are actively planning a commune. We're going to go and buy a big piece of land and all live together on it in tiny houses.
Well, I mean, that's like, that idea to me is very appealing. Like, the idea of just
returning to Monke.
Well, pretty much. Like, and you know what, as well? Like, I really love the idea of like putting myself into situations and being like, would I be able to handle this? I don't know if I could. I'd love to think that I could, but I don't know. Like, I love those videos of those people that have gone, like, I spent a year on an island by myself. Like, those kinds of videos. I find that completely fascinating and compelling because having no contact with the outside world and just being able, like, self-sufficient and having to kind of navigate, like, living in those kinds of situations would be so interesting. Like, I would love to know if I could do it. I don't know if I could, but I'd love to find out. Like, it'd be super interesting.
Do you think it's a desire for simplicity? Because our lives are so overly complex these days. We are bombarded 24/7 with a bad news cycle. We are supposed to be contactable 24/7. Our phones never leave our pockets. And I don't know about you, but unless I actively leave mobile reception or even turning my phone off doesn't do it because then my parents just turn up at my house.
Mm.
I am expected to be contactable at all hours of the day, which has led to an incredibly unhealthy mindset when it comes to work. Also, I just like foresaw the top comment on this video, on this podcast, is going to be sub goal for Ren and Drongo to spend a year on an island. No.
Maybe we could do separate like islands. Two different islands. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, maybe within like binocular range, so we could like make little signs and wave to each other.
I can guarantee my first sign I build is just gonna be a middle finger.
Yeah, that's fair. I was gonna say the same, but you got there first, so whatever. Whatever. It is what it is.
One day it's just gonna be on fire, and you're gonna be like, "Oh, she's in trouble."
But literally, otherwise, it would be on the same island, second day, shallow grave. One of us would be in it.
Yeah.
And I'm scrappy, okay?
I can kick pretty good. I've got little legs, but I can kick. Also, I can run pretty fast, so. Am I allowed to bring the sword?
I don't know.
Can you start a fire with no fire starting equipment?
It's been a long time since I've tried, but yes.
Yeah, same.
Been a very long time.
I became obsessed, not obsessed, but I got really, really interested in when I was in year four, so when I was 9 years old, part of our curriculum, they added a class to our curriculum that was Indigenous Studies. And so every week we would have someone from our local people come in and teach us bush tucker and like where to find water, like clean water and how to start a fire. So naturally, the second that we were let out at recess, I've gone straight for the back of the oval, and I'm trying to start a fire.
Yeah.
As
somebody who also tried to start fires at school, different context, but...
What did you do?
Well, actually, no, it was very similar context. So, no, well, actually, kind of. So, I had a very similar experience because it was year four as well for me, but it was different. But the catalyst was when on our curriculum, we had to read the book Hatchet. And Hatchet those novels are incredible. Have you read them?
Yes.
They are so good. They are incredibly good.
Paul, I can't remember the author's name. His name is Paul.
I don't remember his. I don't remember.
Apologies, Paul. Thank you for writing a fantastic book series. Oh, got another example as well, but keep going.
But those books, because there's a whole series of them. There's like Hatchet Winter, and a whole bunch of other ones. I think there's three. I forget exactly
how many. He kept going back. Dude desired simplicity.
Well, and that's the thing. And like part of like my fascination with like survival was reading these books. And the idea of being in the middle of nowhere, but with nothing but a hatchet and having to survive. So anyway, after reading these books, I would quite routinely go out into the playground and like in amongst playing with my friends, because occasionally we would throw rocks at each other.
The staple game of Australian children. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've also got another story about that, which might explain a lot, but I'll come back to that in a second. But one of the things I would always keep an eye out was for flint, which I didn't really know what I was looking for, but occasionally I'd find a rock and be like, oh shit, I think this is flint. And then I would go around.
It looks awesome.
Yeah. I guarantee you, where I went to school, there was no flint. And I also never succeeded in starting a fire either, so it definitely wasn't flint.
I'm glad to hear that.
But occasionally I would find a rock that I thought was flint, and I would like try to find like something metal to hit it against to see if I could start a fire.
So we just had no unique experiences as children is what I'm hearing.
Apparently not.
Because I read Clan of the Cave Bear, which I don't know if you know what it is.
I have not read that, no.
It's about people that lived back in the Ice Age, and the okay. main character was a young girl, and she was like a medicine woman, so cue me trying to eat every plant I found on the way home from high school. your eyes at me! And then also trying to start fires. And I was looking for flint too, because they went into detail about like flint napping and stuff like that. I'm like, a knife sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
I reckon I could make one out of flint. I couldn't guarantee you I didn't have any flint either. Eventually I found out what it did look like, and I'm like, that's sick. That actually like lines up with the descriptions in the book really well. Another book series I wanted to bring up that might be responsible for our desire to chuck the bindings of modern society is Tomorrow When the War Began.
Yes. Yes. Where I mean, we've talked about this book on the podcast before, but the whole... Have we not?
I don't think so. We talked about maybe the movie?
Oh, interesting. Okay, so for those of you who haven't read Tomorrow When the War Began, it's an Australian novel that is basically Australia gets invaded by an indeterminate foreign military power, and a group of teenagers manage to get to avoid getting captured with the rest of their families and friends by being away in a camping trip in a mountainous area called the Devil's Canyon or something. I forget exactly what it was called.
I think it's just called Hell. I think.
Oh, it is just called Hell.
Hilariously,
yeah.
They just call it Hell. They just call it Hell. The rest of the book, they're like, we're stuck in Hell because yes. It actually does become their personal Hell.
But the way that that's described and the way that they live, like they have this stream in the middle of this like mountainous area. It's very isolated, and they end up making their own little farms in there, and they have their own little living areas and cooking areas and stuff like that. The way that's described, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's an influence
that,
for sure.
That
undoubtedly.
Book series, the first book, and I would say to an extent, I think the first movie did a really good job at this, the dread of when they come back from that camping trip, and you as the reader, if you're doing a reread or if you're watching the movie and you know roughly what it's about, the dread when they come back from that camping trip and realize that their families never came home from the local agricultural show, which is how that's how they rounded them all up, is they planned the invasion. You've got your copy too. Yours is much cooler than mine. Mine is the movie version.
Yeah, this is I think this is one of the originals.
That looks like one of the originals. Yeah.
Well,
so yeah, the invasion was planned at key points on the Australian coast on days when most of the small township would be gathered in one place. So in this town's case, it was the local agricultural show, which happens in, you know, every town and city in Australia. And so basically they went there to have a corn dog and maybe go on the merry-go-round, and then they never came home. And so when the teenagers return from their camping trip, and they find their family homes empty, and they're going from house to house and realizing that no one came home from the agricultural show. There's no one on the roads. You start getting real nervous for them because you're like, they're just out driving around in the daytime and there's enemy patrols going on. Somehow they just avoid them accidentally for the first day. But the dread that it builds, it's a brilliant series. The author's not super great. He's said some comments in recent years that make you go, Mr. Marsden, please make it easier for us to employ Death of the Author. I'd say watch the movie. It didn't get everything right, but it did a pretty good job.
I don't love the movie personally.
I haven't watched it in recent years, but I will say the one thing I loved about the movie is the locations they used for the homes. Because those homes, I don't know about you, but those homes look like places where I grew up. And yep. It was eerie. And it was horrible. And it was, yeah.
Can you take a guess for me when Tomorrow When the First When the War Began was first published.
I'm gonna say 96.
93. So this is actually, this one here is a reprint from 2001.
That's pretty early on. Mine's much newer than that.
So this isn't even close to being one of the first prints. If I had to guess, I would have said this was at least like 99, 2000. I did not realize it was that far back.
No, which also makes sense. Now I'm thinking of, that might have also been something they struggled with the movie adaptation, is the jump in technologies that would have been available.
Well, the thing is that I, reading it, especially when I was a kid, I didn't really ever feel like it, it always felt like it was contemporary. And I wouldn't have read this until I was maybe 11, 12. So that was nearly 20 years after. No, sorry, 10, yeah, about 10 years after it was released.
But there's not a whole lot of modern technology mentioned in the book because of the reasons of the phone lines have been cut, the power lines have been cut. So it really does, they just go back to camping in the wilderness and riding.
And to be fair, at that time, that was before mobile phones were kind of like really popular, and we did just still have landlines everywhere, so I guess that would have still felt relatively contemporary.
I'm getting goosebumps thinking of the scene where they go back to Ellie's house in the movie to begin with, and they take the phone off the hook, and it's just there's nothing.
Mm.
And that's when they start going, something really bad has happened.
Yeah.
And oh, such a good book.
It is great. Definitely.
I connected with it the most because the books are told from a female character's point of view. Her name's Ellie. Mm-hmm. And I think she's 16 or 17. I connected with her immediately. Because as they're on their camping trip, I remember vividly that she gets told to stay away from the fire because she's being a bloody nuisance. And in her head, she's
Stop fiddling with the fire.
We've all heard that where you just were like, no, I'm just fixing the fire. No, you're being a bloody nuisance. Like, that's just such like an Australian experience. I was like, oh boy, do I relate to this.
That is true. I was once a fire fiddler, but I grew out of it.
Fire fiddler. Oh, yeah. That's a great expression for it. Our whole childhoods were engineered to make us want to escape society. Hatchet, Tomorrow When the War Began. We had a lot of stuff that was like, how cool would it be if your parents weren't around?
Okay, but what if these books and these literatures only exist as an extension of these authors' own fantasy about doing such a thing? And it's only a continuation of that existing human urge to return to survival.
So we need to find a turning point in the last century or so, I'm going to say, where we're like, no, this is too comfortable. I brought too much hot water and my blankets are too warm and there's not enough cholera. At what point did we decide that we were too comfy?
Probably around the 60s.
Yeah, I'd say so, maybe.
Probably.
I don't know, because like...
I don't know enough about it.
I'm gonna take a really weird segue here and I apologize.
Okay, sure.
When I was on dating apps.
Okay.
One of the prompts on, I think it's Tinder, is... Tinder has prompts now, by the way. What's your zombie apocalypse plan? Sure. No, I think it might have been Bumble. What's your zombie apocalypse plan was one of the established prompts from Bumble. And that was the response that I got the most replies to.
I think it's very relatable. For the people that have a zombie escape plan, you want to be with another person that has a zombie escape plan.
But I understand. So far, you and I have been talking about gamers and readers and history nerds.
Okay.
That's been our subsection of humanity that we've been examining on a podcast about publishing and content creation.
Yeah.
We've now moved into what is probably a really interesting set of samples of just where your qualifying factor is men, because that's what mine was set to.
Okay, and it's like, right.
That's not taking their interests into account. It was men between this age and this age, and they all had this exact same interest. I would say 90% of them have the same interest of the zombie apocalypse. So it's not just gamers, and it's not just readers, and it's not just history nerds. It's just people, apparently.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying, is like, by putting this on objectively what is a rather unbiased system, Bumble's just interested in showing people of, like, the gender that you've specified and the age range that you've specified. They don't go for similar interests or anything like that, as far as I know.
Okay.
We've eliminated all of those factors and we've boiled it down to, nope, men between the ages of 28 and 34 really like the idea of the zombie apocalypse, which is a large, large subsection of humanity.
Or are they not interested in it per se, but they're just prepared for it?
But that means they've been thinking about it, which displays a level of interest, if, whether it's active or not.
True. True. But I would say that that is entirely possibly influenced by popular media.
True. But at some point, that popular media was so well received that it got greenlit for a whole more bunch of projects.
So what's your point?
That we are fascinated by the idea of returning to basics.
And oh, sure. Bonus, okay, yeah, no, I'm totally point, with you then. I agree.
Yeah, no, we're agreeing. We're just agreeing too hard to the point where we think we're disagreeing.
Okay.
Also, the way that you're sitting between your, I think it's your, like, colo lights on your wall makes it look like you have little Mickey Mouse ears, and it is hilarious to me. No, it's these two. There you go. Yep.
Oh! You ready to have some puns, kids?
No colo lights in the zombie apocalypse, mate.
No. No RGB in the zombie apocalypse.
No. No. So, yeah, that's interesting.
But legitimate question then, what is your zombie escape plan?
Take over a Bunnings.
You really think that you could take and hold a Bunnings?
If I know that the zombie apocalypse is happening, I'm taking the longsword and I'm putting it under siege. I'm going to gather some loyal people, Horbit, who is very scary. And I'm taking him with me to a Bunnings.
I feel like that's a really high-risk strategy.
High risk, high reward. Look at what
you
put in there.
True, because, I mean, but that's the thing, right, is that there's a lot of stuff there that's extremely useful. There's going to be a lot of people like, damn, I'm going to Bunnings.
Yeah. Good luck to him. If they can prove their value to me as queen of the establishment, which I'm now in, then they're
queen
allowed
of the
in.
Bunnings.
But when you think about it, you've got farming tools, you've got weapons, you've got stuff that you can use to barricade the place, you've got seeds to start your little farms, you've got a lot of roof space. We all know that we want to be on the roof during the zombie apocalypse because zombies canonically can't climb or jump.
It very high ceilings. You could very easily have some kind of makeshift kind of cubby house within the warehouse. Yeah, that's true.
Yep. And it is a high value target, but I believe we have the resources to take it. What's your zombie apocalypse plan?
Fair enough. My zombie apocalypse plan is to hike to the mountain.
That's a great one. I think once I've started the mountains,
I'm not a, like, it's a long, long ass walk, but it is entirely plausible for me to get to the Blue Mountains. And one of the incredible things about the Blue Mountains is it is a very, very hard to navigate place. And you can easily find yourself in areas that people have not gone before. Like, a great example of this is the fact that it was only within the last 20 years they found a species of tree there that was thought to be extinct for thousands of years. Like, there is really remote areas within the mountains. So my plan is to go to the mountains, forget about having a melee with everybody over resources, and just have my kit and go get out of there.
I think, actually, speaking to the remoteness of those mountains, I do believe that's tomorrow where the war began, is it?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is set in the Blue Mountains. I think it's set in a different set of mountains, but it is a very similar scenario. You're right.
Yeah, they talk about the inaccessibility of it playing a key part in keeping them safe.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the thing as well, right? Is like, in those sorts of situations, like uneven terrain, hard to navigate terrain like that, causes all kinds of issues for people who are trying to get in there. But a single person, oh, hang on, I've got somebody at the door. Give me 2 seconds.
I'll take this moment to, what should I do? You should definitely go and watch all of Drongo's content. He's doing some great stuff recently with Skyrim I think he's doing an AI mod with his companion Herika. It's been making for some very, very funny moments, so I'd highly recommend going and checking out Bloody Drongo on TikTok. I don't know his handle, but you should be able to find him. And basically just go binge watch his content with Herika, because it is hilarious. And I don't think he knows, but I would like to marry his AI companion because she is a sass queen. So highly recommend that. You also need to make sure that you go and follow him over on Twitch. He's doing amazing work over there as well. And I do believe, we haven't talked about this before, I think he's going to PAX. A couple of them. Maybe just one. I'm not sure. Okay, he's back. I'm going to pretend I've been shilling my own stuff. And that is why you should make sure to be buying Sky Nation publishing titles.
Very good. I'm glad to hear that you've been spruking up the products while we've been gone.
Oh, yes.
Sorry about that. I was expecting a parcel and it has now arrived. So that's good news.
We love to see parcels arriving when they're supposed to.
Yes.
Which I can segue. Look at this, a segue. We've been having some major issues with the Tales of Aeolian Chainmail release. You and I have spoken about this at length. It has caused quite a bit of controversy in the Sky Nation Publishing Slack chat, which is that we had over a dozen parcels go missing. A dozen orders never reached their location. I was notified of another one last night, so I had to redo that order this morning, which a rough estimate has put us at a loss of close to 2,000 Australian dollars, which is rough and sucks. And this is one of the reactive things that we were talking about. So now we're trying to find a way around having parcels go missing for the next release.
Yes.
I'm also trying to
unfortunately, it's just part of doing business, I suppose, but yeah, definitely not an ideal situation. Are you okay? You look like you really suffered there at the end.
This residue on the rim of the glass is pure rogue energy, and I just hoovered some up. It's a bit intense. It's good.
Okay, good, good. I'm glad we touched on that.
Yeah, it was a bit of a lesson that I couldn't have foreseen because, oh no, I'm playing into your point before of how do we make legislation for something that hasn't happened yet? Okay, cool, point taken. Yeah, because we hadn't done a release of that scale before, I couldn't have foreseen so many parcels going missing, and I shouldn't have had to, but alas, that is the way that the world doesn't work. And so, yeah, big financial loss, which stings a lot, and will definitely influence the way that we do releases in the future.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's one of the big things about shipping and logistics that is just not that much fun. And I mean, I've worked in like logistics warehouses before. So when I lived in the UK, I worked for a company called Synram, and I drove these big VNA forklifts, which are basically forklift trucks that go 11 meters up in the air, and they're very fun. Best first day I've ever had on a job, because the first thing you have to learn before you even learn how to drive the things is you need to be able to abseil out of the cab of the truck in case there's a fire and that power goes out and you need to be able to evacuate the building. So the very first thing they teach you is how to abseil out of the truck, and that was best first day of a job ever. It was great.
That's amazing. And that's just reminded me that you owe me another story of you throwing rocks at your friends.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, true. All right, well, let me finish my point about logistics and then remind me of the rocks. So working in this warehouse, you are processing hundreds of pallets as an individual every, you know, eight hours, hundreds and thousands of pallets. And you would basically be doing what is called picking and packing, where you would basically have a centralized distribution hub where trucks would come off and drop off their product and pallets of product. And then it would be stored in the warehouse. And then there would be other trucks that would come in to pick up parcels to be distributed to other places. So you would have to then go back in to the warehouse rows to pull out or pick the pallets of the things that need to be shipped back out and put them back out to where the front is. And they would have like a whole system for managing that. But In the process of this, sometimes pallets would be poorly packed, sometimes there might be water damage, sometimes there just might be human error and you drop a pallet because, you know, you've got like dozens of rows of pallets all stacked on top of each other in these giant shelves, essentially. And it's very easy to just like misjudge it with the prong of the forklift and just knock it off and it will just topple down and then it might fall on a couple of other pallets on the way down and damage other things. And so like when you've got like even that alone, they would have an expectation that generally of all of the product you send out is going to be like at least 5 to 10% of it is just going to end up broken, lost, or just completely unsellable. And that's just kind of like when you're dealing at volume, just one of the risks of doing business, unfortunately. So yeah,
I guess I should just be grateful that we can consider our problems to be one born of operating at large volume.
Yeah,
we had such a large amount of orders that of course like there was going to be some spillage. So
yeah,
boy, this feels like the time that Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, this feels like the time that we had to register for GST because it was like, yay, we're earning enough to register for another tax. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's a roller coaster.
Yeah, it is a roller coaster. But we'll get there. We'll get there. You know, we've learned a lot of lessons from this release and we will get there.
Oh, I'm so looking forward. There's a book we've got coming out next year called Beasts of London. Preliminary market testing, like people are clamoring for it and it feels good, and I know our author is super excited. That's an announcement we can do. We now have a junior editor working for Sky Nation Publishing. I'd love to get her on the podcast at some point because I think she's really got some insights into the publishing industry that people might find interesting, and I know that she's keen to start work on it, I'm keen to start work on it, and I know we've got people keen to read it. So I think of all the releases we've got next year, I think that's the one I'm most excited for. I'm so keen to start work on it properly. I've already I shouldn't admit it, but I've broken the schedule a little bit and I started working on it early. But don't you roll your eyes at me.
What else can I do besides roll my eyes at you? Okay.
Rock story.
Rock story. Yeah, let me tell you the rock story. So when I was in year one at school, so for those of you who are overseas, that may not make a lot of sense. I was about 6 years old. I would go down to the back of the playground with my friends. And at the back of the playground, there was a whole bunch of trees. And under those trees, it was kind of like there was just rocks everywhere to stop grass growing and just being dirt, I guess. But there were all these rocks. And so we would get handfuls of rocks and we would play a game that we called Volcano. And we would get giant handfuls of rocks and then throw them up into the tree. And then they would start coming down from the tree and hitting branches and going like in all different directions. And the game was that you would have to throw a handful of rocks up in the tree. You'd all have to stand as a group. And then you'd have to dodge all the rocks that were coming down from the tree. And obviously, you would get hit by the rocks in the head. And there's no other part to this story other than I think that really explains maybe where it all started to go wrong.
The second you said the name of the game, I envisioned the premise. And also, I love that we're going to round out this podcast by me comparing AI transformative experiences to a Plinko board, and you lived a real life game of it where you were the bottom of the Plinko board.
I was the bottom of the Plinko board. Exactly. That is what you can take away from this podcast. Everybody, thank you for listening. This has been TN Tales with Renee Sky and Bloody Drongo. And we are all Plinko boards.
You're a human Plinko board with your own experiences. I do want to just round out real quick by saying I've had a lot of people, and this was before the rise of AI, one of the most common, not complaints, but most common worries that I got from people that I worked with in terms of teaching writing was that they were worried there was no original ideas left. And the answer that I gave, keeping in mind this is before AI, was that there are no original ideas anymore. There's just not. But there are original executions, and that's because we have different voices as humans. Everyone's voice is unique to them. Exhibit A, I was teaching a class of year 8 kids, I think, so 13-year-olds. And a little boy asked that question. He wasn't a little boy, he was a teenage boy, asked that question. And so I gave them a prompt. I gave them all the same prompt, and they all turned out different pieces of writing. And that's what I use as an example of, you guys can literally be all given the same thing, and you will create different works. And guess what? They were all transformative, so they were all covered by copyright, because they were written by humans. And that's how I'm going to leave this. I didn't even get that mad. I'm so proud of myself.
Well done.
I did instigate a gladiator ring as a showdown, though, so maybe I shouldn't be patting myself on the back too hard.
Perfect. All right, well, to round it out, Ren, why don't you tell people, everybody, about who you are, where you can they can find you, and also where they can find all of the wonderful books that we've been talking about.
My name is Renee April. I'm online as Renee Sky. I'm the creative director of Sky Nation Publishing. We're an independent publishing house based here in Brisbane, Australia. You can buy our books at skynation.info. Buying directly from us is much cheaper and also allows us to pay our authors and creatives more. You can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/Renee Sky, and I am on Twitter as Renee on Twitch. What about you, Drongo?
I am Bloody Drongo. I am a content creator, actor, a voice actor. Well, I can be an actor as well. Why not? And an artist. And I also do business consulting, which is why I work with Ren. And you can find me usually on Twitter as @TheBloodyDrongo or on Twitch as just Bloody Drongo. Thanks for listening.
Could you also do me a favor, and spruik your TikTok handle as well?
Sure. My TikTok handle is @Bloody.Drongo.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for listening to episodes 5 of TN Tales.
Nice. Nailed it. Episode 5, done and dusted.